From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Trump is said to be preparing a slew of pardons in his last days in office. It's not clear if he'll pardon himself, which would mean he can't be investigated and prosecuted for any federal crimes. And much of Washington, D.C. is on lockdown for Wednesday's inauguration of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. Joining us is NPR White House correspondent Tamara Keith. Hi, Tam.
Hi.
And boy, it sounds so chilling. Thousands of National Guard troops stationed around D.C., streets and bridges near the Capitol and the White House closed. Tell us more about the security concerns right now.
Certainly, an inauguration is always a high security event. This is only amplified by the fact that there was an insurrection 2 weeks ago, 2 weeks to the day before Joe Biden will take the oath of office on that west front of the Capitol. The west front was swarmed with a pro-Trump mob that ultimately took the Capitol for several hours. As you say, there is concern that they aren't done.
Well, President Trump won't be there for the swearing in. Remind us where he'll be.
He is getting an early start on his trip to Florida. What we know is that in the morning he will have a send-off ceremony at Joint Base Andrews, where Air Force One is based. And it is not unheard of to have a send-off of some kind. We don't know how big it will be or what it will include. President Trump has a way of keeping everyone in suspense. But we do know that that will all be over and he will be gone and off to Florida by the time Biden is sworn in. And obviously that is a break with about 150 years of American tradition of honoring a peaceful transfer of power. But this transfer of power hasn't been peaceful or particularly cooperative.
Yeah. And what have we learned about what President-elect Joe Biden will do on his first day as President Biden in terms of policy?
He has plans to sign a bunch of executive orders. Ron Klain, his incoming chief of staff, laid out in a memo 10 days of executive actions aimed at, in part, reversing a lot of what President Trump did through executive action, and also going further than that. He cites four key crises facing the Biden administration: the economic crisis, the COVID-19 crisis, the climate crisis, and a racial equity crisis, as he puts it. On the first day, Biden will rejoin the Paris Climate Agreement. He will ask the Department of Education to extend the pause on student loan repayments. He will also reverse what's known as the Muslim ban that President Trump signed early on in his presidency that caused so much chaos and was thrown out in court multiple times and had to be signed multiple times. And he's also going to issue a challenge asking people to wear masks and also mandating them on federal property and interstate travel.
Yeah. And he's also going to take office without a single confirmed cabinet member. There have been some things going on. So how fast will the Senate get to that if they're also taking up President Trump's second impeachment trial?
It's a big open question. There are now hearings scheduled for several of his nominees, in particular national security related nominees. But we don't know how quick this process will go or how it will mesh up with a potential impeachment trial, when that would start and how all consuming that will be, whether they can split the day or not.
And before you go, some of the rioters are asking President Trump to pardon them. What do we know about who's on his list?
We don't know a lot. We do know that we are watching it closely. And we also know that President Trump, throughout his presidency, has issued pardons to political friends and others who he likes or have been helpful to him. He has not gone through the traditional process through the Justice Department of vetting people to be pardoned, which is a departure and is likely to continue with these pardons as well.
And we got a couple more seconds here. Do we know who's going to represent the president in his impeachment trial?
We know a lot more about who's not going to represent him than we know about who is going to represent him. Jonathan Karl of ABC interviewed Rudy Giuliani, who said that he would represent him, then later said, never mind, I won't be representing him because he could be a witness, because he also spoke at that January 6th rally. And Jay Sekulow, who represented Trump before in impeachment, will not be part of the team.
Okay, NPR's Tamara Keith, thank you.
You're welcome.
Every year around this time, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech is resurrected.
Let freedom freedom ring. When we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands.
And some years this timeless message holds even more resonance, like this year, as we're confronted with the massive inequality that exists in our country, laid bare by the police killings of black people, the disproportionate impacts of COVID-19 on communities of color, and the differences in treatment of far-right extremists at this month's insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. Joining us on Skype to reflect on MLK Day is Ruby Bridges. As a child, she was the first black student to desegregate an elementary school in New Orleans. Ruby, welcome and thank you for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. What a year this has been for our country and the world. What are you reflecting on this MLK Day?
You are absolutely right about that. What a year. What comes to mind right away is that if we do not learn from our history, we are doomed to repeat it. Mm-hmm. And that's what this year feels like for me.
I read that when you saw people taking to the streets over the summer to protest the killings of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, the first words that came to your mind were, "It's about time." This all felt so familiar because of your own experience.
Yes, I did feel that way. And what I meant about that was the fact that, yes, it looked exactly like it did in 1960 when I was, you know, going up those stairs to first grade, not really knowing what I was seeing at the time. That in itself reminded me that the young people that I'd been speaking to all these years probably feel the same way, like not really understanding what was happening right before their eyes. But definitely it looked as if history was repeating itself. And I felt for a very, very long time that our young people really needed a cause to get behind. I remember being excited when the Parkland kids took to the streets over the gun violence in schools. We all know that Dr. King actually used young people in his movement. And I just felt like it was about time. I mean, there's so many ills in the world and we need all the good foot soldiers we can get to actually help us.
Your story is forever seared into our collective consciousness. There's that Norman Rockwell portrait of you just 6 years old, bravely walking into William France Elementary School. It's just so resonant. There's the Bria Gulyer's depiction of that same portrait with incoming Vice President Kamala Harris walking behind you. That serves as a reminder of how far we've come. But your story in particular is still very important to hear today. What do you want people to remember about your experience as they make sense of what we're seeing?
Well, you know, I think what's important about my story is the fact that I was 6 years old, not really knowing anything about disliking someone because of the color of their skin, to remind people that all of our babies come into the world with a clean heart, a fresh start in life, to remind them that it is us, we as adults, we take racism and we pass it on to our kids. And that is why we are seeing what we are seeing now, 60 years later, and that all of us as adults, we have a responsibility to make sure that our kids understand that, that it has no place. I believe I'm so dedicated to that because I just think that no child should have to go through what I did at 6 years old.
You talk about this pretty extensively in your book. You're also a mother of four sons. I've been thinking a lot about the mothers on Friday in particular, MLK's birthday. I was thinking a lot about his mother's pain and sacrifice. You make a point in your book to say exactly what you're saying, that we should not sugarcoat brutality and the realities of racism, that it's a grown-up disease that is passed on from adults to children, as you're saying. Do you think this country is anywhere near getting to that root of the disease?
I sure hope so. I mean, I can't say for sure, especially after what we just saw, the attack on the Capitol. And I think that we have to be diligent about teaching our kids right from wrong and loving one another. We have to also teach them that they have to take the torch and pass it on. We cannot become laxed at this. And we have to remain hopeful. And we have to do it together. You know, united we stand, divided we fall. After this last election, I think all of us really, I was shocked. And I'm sure there are lots of us who were shocked just how divided this country really is.
That's Ruby Bridges, civil rights activist and author of the children's book, This Is Your Time, reflecting on her experience and the state of our country on this Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Ruby Bridges, thank you so much for this conversation.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Prominent Russian dissident Alexei Navalny knew that when he returned to Moscow from Germany yesterday, he'd be arrested upon landing, and he was. He was in Germany recuperating from a coma brought on by a Russian-developed poison. Today, he sat in a makeshift courtroom hearing in a police station just outside Moscow, his lawyer given just minutes to get there, to find out if he is to be kept in jail. NPR's Moscow correspondent Lucian Kim has been following Navalny's struggles against Putin's government. Lucian, there's video of his arrest. He gets to passport control, kisses his wife on the cheek, and is led away. Both sides knew what was going to happen, right?
Oh, sure. This is not surprising in the least. In the weeks leading up to Navalny's return, the authorities made clear they would go after him for probation violations on a previous conviction during the time he was out of the country. Navalny has had legal problems ever since he became politically active. To be clear, the Kremlin did not want Navalny to return in the first place. They would have preferred him to become an exile. President Vladimir Putin was faced with this catch-22 of either arresting him and sparking international outrage, which has happened, or letting him go free and looking weak inside the country, especially to his own entourage.
Yeah. Well, and the government is charging him with the things he's charging the government with. He's an anti-corruption crusader. In this impromptu hearing in the police station, he spoke to supporters in a video. Let's listen to a little.
Это невозможно то, что происходит здесь. Это просто какой-то наивысшей степени беззакония.
Lucian Kim, Navalny there saying what's happening here is not possible. It's the height of lawlessness. But what happens now?
Well, again, not surprisingly, the judge in this case ruled to keep him in custody for 30 days. Now, Navalny has gained his following inside Russia mainly via social media. Navalny in the past has been very effective in mobilizing Russians to take to the streets, not just in Moscow or St. Petersburg, but in smaller cities across the country. He is acutely aware that if there's one thing Putin really hates, it's street protests, because there's something he can't control.
Yeah. Why did he come back knowing he'd immediately be arrested?
Well, part of Navalny's brand and his whole appeal is being fearless. Nothing has stopped him in the past from organizing protests, investigating corrupt government schemes, or now accusing Putin of trying to kill him. So it would have been out of character for him not to return. When I interviewed Navalny a couple of years ago, he told me he wants to live in Russia, and he refuses to accept people who say that Russia is somehow doomed to be a bad place to live. Also very important, Robin, he returns to Russia with an international stature he did not have before he was poisoned. Joe Biden said during the election he'd hold Putin accountable for Navalny's poisoning. And in Europe, there are already calls for new sanctions against the Kremlin. Navalny sees himself as a serious alternative to Putin, and that's why he came back.
Yeah. NPR Moscow correspondent Lucian Kim, thank you so much.
Thanks, Robin.
This Wednesday, 22-year-old Amanda Gorman, the nation's first youth poet laureate, will become the youngest person to read her poetry at the presidential inauguration. She was chosen to share her work by incoming First Lady Jill Biden, who's a big fan. Gorman follows in the footsteps of Maya Angelou and Robert Frost. Last year, during the pandemic and calls for racial justice, Amanda Gorman joined us to talk about her poetry and how it can offer hope and understanding. Here's a bit of our conversation from this past October. So your work focuses on issues of race and feminism and oppression. You're one of the rare few who knew your path very early in life. How has the last 4 years, and specifically the last few months with this country's grappling with racism, shaped your view of your purpose in this moment?
As a writer, I'm also writing as an African American, so these issues are very much so intimate and personal. For me, I think we have our own kind of weapons that we can take into the arena to fight systemic racism. And for me, the greatest instrument that I have at my disposal is my pen. And so I try to create messages of both kind of critical thinking, but also of hope, to be both thinking deeply and also constructively about what we can do with the racial tensions in our country.
One example of that, I'm going to have you read one of your poems. You're a self-proclaimed history buff, and you have a poem to share with us that takes a look at a portion of Thomas Jefferson's Notes on the State of Virginia, where he claimed it was impossible for Black people to write poetry, including Phyllis Wheatley, the first Black American to have a book of poetry published in 1773. Can you read that poem for us?
Certainly. Notes on the State of Virginia. Notes on the state, I find, uttered a thought the level of plain. Never painting or sculpture, music gifted. Whites have been found capable of imagining. Whether they will be the composition of a more extensive or complicated harmony is yet to be proved. Misery is often. Poetry is misery enough. God knows poetry. Love is peculiar of the poet, ardent, but it kindles only the imagination. Religion, indeed. A Phyllis could produce, published under her name, the dignity of.
You know, you're a manifestation of everything Thomas Jefferson tried to deny as a possibility. How does it feel to reshape this assertion? In a way, you're really correcting history through poetry.
I think that's a really interesting way of thinking about it. I try to kind of live history through my poetry. I should contextualize this poem in that when Thomas Jefferson was basically condemning Phyllis Wheatley's poetry, she was around my age, if not younger than I was. And so for him to dedicate time in this historical document to try to erase her from having any type of poetic claim, I think says a lot about what one skinny, small, young Black girl poet can do to disrupt humanity. I talk a lot about imagination in this poem when I'm kind of erasing Thomas Jefferson's words and creating this poem. That is also in part inspired by Claudia Rankine's Citizen, which very much so deals with police brutality. And she has an incredible line there that says, "Because white men can't police their imagination, Black people are dying."
You know, the arts have always been used as a way for us to make sense of the world. You teach young people about how to use poetry for transformative change. What's the response to the medium from the young people you work with?
The response is always incredibly rewarding. You know, my role isn't to convert everyone to become a poet laureate, but I want every single young person to have the capacity to share their voice. And if poetry can help make that journey accessible, I'm here for it.
You also consider yourself an activist, and I would imagine that you don't separate yourself, like I'm a poet and I'm an activist. How do you see these working in concert with each other?
I definitely see them working together. It's always so strange to me when someone says, "Oh, I'd love for you to write this poem, but don't make it political." And I kind of freeze because it makes no sense to me. Everything is political, especially art. And I think often that's a word that is misappropriated to say, don't have this poem ask difficult questions and begin complicated conversations. So for me, kind of a sociopolitical interest is already embedded in my poetry, and it's, you know, impossible, if not so counterpoint to who I am, to eradicate, I should say, that concern from that art.
It's been important for you as a writer and activist to have something to guide you, and you call it a mantra. So I wonder, what is your mantra?
This literary talisman I came up with a few years ago, and I recite it to myself in times of great fear and anxiety. And it goes, "I am the daughter of Black writers. We're descended from freedom fighters who broke their chains and changed the world. They call me." And it's just something I recite to myself, and it helps give me strength. I think as homework for anyone listening to this, I would just challenge you to think of the history that you stand on and the future you stand for. And to create something really explicit for yourself to repeat in times of darkness, just to remind yourself of the light that you bring just by living.
How are you 22?
I'm like 89 in like a 12-year-old's body.
Do you have another poem you'd like to share with us?
Sure. I will read another poem that I wrote called What Words Begin. And it was inspired when I was doing a bit of kind of historical research of when race really was used in the historical record. What Words Begin. The word race first arose in the English language in 1508. Of course, it appeared where all words are born. A poem. When a Scottish writer spoke of a long line of kings and the dancing, deadly sin of envy. So what is a poem, if not a beginning? An announcement that heralds itself. Moments of air molded like a melted wax. I always thought language was akin to the body, padlocked oh so delicately to a pulse. It tells you in the beginning was the word. This was before 1619, before Trayvon, before Till, before Malcolm and Martin and Michael went still. Before the echo that is breath's pilgrimage to the start of the sound. Before the inception of a new poem, when I am bent and gasping, stripped skinny, thatched thin, a wild note waiting to be sung.
That was Amanda Gorman reciting one of her poems when I spoke to her back in October of last year. And you can hear the full poem at hereandnow.org.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from MIT's System Design and Management, jointly offered by MIT's School of Engineering and the MIT Sloan School of Management. Earn a master's in engineering and management. STM educates mid-career professionals to solve complex challenges at the intersection of business and technology. With over 20 years of on-campus, hybrid, and distance education experience, join a virtual info session on Thursday, January 21st from 7 to 8 p.m. sdm.mit.edu.
To become a world champion in freediving, Tanya Streeter learned to breathe like this. Ideas about air, breath, and breathing. That's on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
As one of his final acts before he was assassinated, Martin Luther King Jr. fought for basic income for all as part of what he called the Poor People's Campaign. Today, that fight continues. This past Friday, about 1,000 fast food workers went on strike to coincide with MLK's 92nd birthday, calling for lawmakers to pass a $15 an hour minimum wage. President-elect Joe Biden is also proposing a $15 federal minimum wage as part of his coronavirus relief package. For more, let's bring in Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Hi, Robin.
Hey, Tanya.
So this Fight for 15 movement, which helped organize the fast food worker strike, cites MLK's push for a basic income for all. They argue he would have supported the cause. How are these two movements, racial justice and minimum wage, intertwined in this moment?
People of color overwhelmingly depend on minimum wage jobs in the United States in 2021. I mean, be they in fast food, grocery, mall, retail, and many of these same workers were deemed essential during the pandemic, but couldn't take for granted paid sick leave, benefits. Oftentimes, you know, they defaulted to the social safety net. And most immediately, they couldn't take for granted a wage that could cover rent, food, and childcare. All that was in brutally sharp relief last year. A living wage. So if you're just making ends meet, you're not saving or investing or building wealth in a home, and then you stagnate for decades.
Mm-hmm. That strike was on Friday. I'm wondering how fast food companies and other businesses that rely on these low-wage workers are reacting to this movement.
Yeah, look, there's no shortage of small biz out there saying that this is going to have the unintended consequence of reducing hours, hiking menu prices, just as customers can least afford it. Restaurants in particular, they're in outright depression. They're trying to hang on for dear life. But after a year of hazard pay, you know, grueling hours, worker burnout, and even COVID infections at many restaurants and stores, other managers and companies are hiking on their own. They realize that the kind of the bill is due. And yet there's another thing to worry about. How much of these jobs are going to be, canceled out by automation? There's this argument that hiking the minimum wage is going to push more workers out of the workforce as robots take over.
As I mentioned, Biden is proposing the first minimum wage hike in over a decade. I mean, the federal minimum wage has stayed at $7.25 per hour since 2009. He wants to make it to 15, but what obstacles do you think he could face in making this happen?
Well, under typical Senate rules, you're going to need about 10 more votes than what the Democrats will have in total in the U.S. Senate with the Kamala Harris tiebreaker. Up for debate is if this can be done with a simple 51-vote majority through budget reconciliation. So if the Biden administration does have to enter into contentious negotiations with Senate Republicans, does $15 then become a long-term goal that the country commits to however many years down the line?
Okay, before I let you go, help us understand why so many lawmakers and activists are actually reaching for that $15 an hour number. Why that amount?
Put it back in context. Let me take you back 31 years. The federal minimum wage was at $4.25 an hour. It took until 2009 for it to go up to $7.25. That's been the case for 12 years now. So does that even keep up with inflation or the real world cost of living? I mean, essentially, tripling it from where we were 30 years ago. That's very much open for debate, but you're seeing a lot of swing states, a lot of people who would have otherwise recoiled in horror saying, no, it's time to truly consider $15.
That's Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. As always, thank you.
My pleasure.
What to make of the apps popping up that claim to alert people if they've been near someone infected with the coronavirus, or apps people can use to prove they've been vaccinated against the virus? Are they accurate? Are they ethical? Let's take a look, starting with the Common Pass app from the not-for-profit Geneva-based Commons Project and the World Economic Forum. The app began as a way to deliver medical information to users. It's pivoted with the pandemic to relay information about tests and soon vaccination requirements for travel and elsewhere. Last week, a consortium of tech and health companies like Microsoft and the Mayo Clinic joined the Commons Project effort. Paul Meyer is the CEO of the Commons Project. Paul, take us through how someone would use this app.
Yeah, really what Common Pass does is lets a user download it and then connect it to either their lab result or their vaccination record. And then they can use it to basically demonstrate that they either have been tested or have been vaccinated and complied with the requirements of their destination, whether it's a country, whether it's an airline, a school, a workplace, a concert venue.
Well, we understand that's on the horizon. This is like a digital version of the yellow health card that many of us have, you know, you take when you travel to show the shots you've had so you can gain entry to foreign countries. There are other apps as well. IBM has the digital health pass. And we understand right now, if you're traveling, this app might direct you, if you're at the airport, where you can go to maybe get a quick COVID test if it's required for a flight.
That's right. And this is going to become more and more important. The CDC just introduced a requirement for all inbound travelers to the United States to be tested within 72 hours before boarding a flight to the United States. So beginning on January 26, every individual, U.S. citizen or otherwise, who is flying into the United States is going to have to get tested and be able to present evidence of that test before they can be boarded onto a flight.
Do you worry that this idea of a digital health pass is going to add to the inequity we're already seeing in the pandemic? Some people don't have smartphones. They don't have access to free testing. You know, we already are feeling when we travel that there's a lane for somehow special people and a lane for everybody else. Do you worry that this will add to that?
Well, the way we've architected it is in a way that actually can support paper as well. So there's a way that either labs or vaccination sites can actually issue a piece of paper with a 2D barcode with something that's called a verifiable credential, which means the paper itself can be verified to ensure its accuracy. So it can be inclusive.
Now, you're a nonprofit. Are these free?
The app is absolutely free. We are a nonprofit. It's being operated as a sort of common public trust for the world. But I also think that access is a really critical topic to talk about. And countries for a long time have, for example, required documentation of yellow fever vaccination to enter some countries. Schools require vaccination for children to be registered for schools. Los Angeles County just announced that children would have to be vaccinated for COVID-19 to return to school in Los Angeles County. But again, these are critical decisions that those communities and those institutions are going to need to make.
And to be clear, you're saying that your app will allow people to print off a paper version of their test or vaccination results at even a public computer that they could then take with them when they go on a flight. As I said, you're a nonprofit and you started this work for East African countries to help people verify health information. For instance, was it truck drivers? You know,
Four of the six countries of the East Africa community are landlocked. And when COVID struck, the borders got closed and they needed to let truckers basically bring food from like the port of Mombasa into, you know, Uganda and Rwanda. So it really, you know, the work began in trying to solve for enabling truck drivers to actually cross borders to bring food and other vital supplies.
By showing that they had tested negative for
COVID. Just showing they've been tested in one country, and therefore, you know, the destination country felt comfortable letting them cross the border.
Yeah. But what about privacy? And this in the past has always been the role of the government. Now it feels as if the government is ceding this to tech companies. How can you ensure someone's health privacy?
The way the Common Pass app is structured is that you pull your health records into the app, but they're stored only on your phone, and you're the only one who has control of that record. What Common Pass does is confirms that you actually have the lab results or the vaccination records and sends a yes or no answer to that destination about whether or not you satisfy the requirements, but you don't actually have to hand over your underlying health information. That's yours, it's protected, it never leaves your phone. I think this is all about risk reduction. This is about giving both people more confidence that they can start to reengage and also giving communities and institutions the confidence to begin to open up borders again, allow travel to resume.
Yeah. That's Paul Meyer of the Common Pass app. I'll link you up at herenow.org. Paul, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And now to apps that say they notify people on their smartphones about whether they've spent time near people who've tested positive for the coronavirus. They're called virus exposure apps. New York Times tech writer Jennifer Valentino DeVries has taken a deep look here. So, Jennifer, we know Google and Apple have created these apps. How do they work?
So they work by using the Bluetooth that is on a lot of people's smartphones. And the Bluetooth sends out signals and can detect if other phones are nearby. It's figuring out what phones are near you and whether they're, you know, within about 6 feet for more than 15 minutes or so. And if that person then later gets a positive coronavirus test, the system will alert you that you were exposed to them. Kind of go back in time and tell people that you saw, you know, 3 days ago that they now need to isolate and get tested in a couple of days and so forth.
It's kind of like a digital contact tracing. But how does the system know that the person had a positive coronavirus test?
So the apps have to work with health departments, and those health departments get a code under the system that Apple and Google have created, and they can give the infected person this code to enter into their app and agree and say, I want to alert the people I was around, you know, in the past 5 days, you know, whenever they started becoming infectious, and the system knows to send out the alert to people who were around you.
Well, boy, I mean, you have to hope that most people will want to participate. What do you do about that human aspect of this?
So I think that is a big question in the rollout of this technology. You know, I followed some pilot studies, and they did find that even people who signed up to use the apps, when they tested positive, when it really came time to make the decision whether to put their information in there saying that, you know, yes, I tested positive, some percentage of them balked.
Allay those security fears.
Okay, so I think that there is a misunderstanding that this is tracking your location, and it is not doing that. You know, I think for a lot of the digital tracking that we have become concerned about, there's a financial motive. And in this case, There are engineers who are privacy engineers, security engineers at the tech giants, and were able to persuade, you know, the leadership of those companies to be involved in this. And it is not actually tied to advertising or the things that are usually driving that kind of location collection. And I don't know, I don't often trust the tech companies either. But in this case, after talking with a lot of experts who have looked at the code, they are saying that it is secure.
You say the biggest problem with this is that people don't know about it. Why don't people know about it?
Well, you know, I think there's a lot going on right now. I think
really?
The biggest things that people need to do, you know, involve wearing masks and distancing and getting tested and responding to contact tracers if they call you. But I think that given that Apple and Google have done the heavy lifting here and are really presenting this technology to states to use, you know, I think that it's a good thing. You could have 20% of the state's population using this app, and it could still make a difference in terms of reducing infections.
Yeah. Are you using it?
I am. And actually, I got an alert. I knew somebody who tested positive, and I was alerted.
It worked.
Yeah, it did work. It told me. So
great. Jennifer Valentino DeVries, New York Times tech guru on a coronavirus exposure app from Apple and Google. We'll link you up to more information at hereandnow.org. Jennifer, thank you.
Thank you so much.
President-elect Joe Biden will sign around a dozen executive orders shortly after he takes office on Wednesday, including rejoining the Paris Climate Accord. The agreement commits countries to reducing heat-trapping climate change emissions. Meanwhile, the U.S. is moving ahead with fracking, the extraction of cheap natural gas to replace coal and generate electricity. 173 new gas-fired power generators operate across the country, according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration. In Ohio, 10 new plants have been planned and constructed in the last few years. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports on one of those plants being built in eastern Ohio.
Kevin and Marlene Young built their house in the country so they had space for horses.
I was raised around horses, and that's my love.
Their horses, with names like Buckeye Blast and Creekside Pete, aren't just pets. They built a half-mile track to train them as race horses, and they've won tens of thousands of dollars.
We're getting ready to retire. Thought we had it handled. We were going to do the horses and relax. About even got it all paid for.
But now, big trucks drive past the house throughout the day. The farm field next door has become an industrial construction site. The air is often filled with dust. Some nights, bright construction lights shine through their windows.
I mean, come on, man. That's unbelievable.
In the summer of 2019, Caithness Energy started building one of the largest gas plants of its kind in the country. There's already a pipeline that will run natural gas from Pennsylvania and Ohio to the site. The Guernsey Power Station will generate enough power for 1.5 million homes. But the Youngs don't want to live next door to it.
My dishes shake, my bedroom is on the second floor, and it's like you put a quarter in one of them beds, that's how it vibrates.
In November, Ohio EPA issued two notices of violation to the company that's building the plant for Caithness for problems with erosion and sediment running off the property. But other damage has already been done. Kevin Young says one of their horses got startled by the construction equipment just over the fence and injured itself.
And she was laid up for a month, and we had to dress his leg every day.
Between incidents like that and the dusty air, the Youngs have stopped training their horses, even putting them on respirators. Marlene falls apart when she talks about their best horse, Creekside Pete.
I had to sell him to get him out of here because of the stuff going on, so I sold him so he wouldn't hurt himself.
The Youngs want Caithness to buy them out, as it did for three other families who live near the construction, according to county records. Like the Youngs, some reported cracks in their walls, and some had black water in their homes after construction started.
The company declined to comment about these claims. In an email, a spokesperson for Caithness said the Guernsey Power Station will have access to an abundant, stable supply of clean-burning natural gas from the Utica and Marcellus shale formations in the region. Many people in the area also see the new gas plant as a hope for the region's future. When Caithness first came here in 2016, Norm Blanchard, economic development director for the region, was thrilled by the idea of a $1.6 billion plant.
For us, it was almost like a carnival coming to town.
The company is spending millions to prepare the site and has promised $42 million to the local school system over 30 years. It promised 1,000 construction jobs. When it opens in 2022, it will employ 25 high-tech workers. Blanchard wishes it was more, but he's not complaining. As he stands along the highway looking at the huge construction site, he says all the cranes are like a billboard for economic development.
Something like this, to be able to locate it here, puts you on the map. That kind of development is coming to Guernsey County. There's other things that we can do.
In Baysville, where this plant is being built, poverty is more than twice the national average. Environmental attorney Dave Altman says many communities jump at the money and jobs offered by deep-pocketed energy companies.
Local governments, somewhat understandably at times, blindly accept promises and operate in denial to the collateral damage to the people who are left behind.
Kevin and Marlene Young say they haven't gotten help from the government on any level. There are no local zoning codes or land use restrictions. And while Ohio has strict laws ensuring wind turbines aren't built too close to homes, the state has no such requirement for gas plants. Recently, the Trump administration also removed a rule in Ohio's federal air quality plan that protects people from environmental nuisances like dust and odors that endanger health and property.
They would have been able for 40 years to take that evidence into court, and now they won't be able to do that directly anymore.
In an email, Ohio EPA said it retains authority and can enforce the nuisance rule. Ohio EPA said pollution levels outside the facility will not cause harm. But the Youngs don't want to wait to find out. Marlene has recently started having serious health issues, and Kevin wants to protect them both.
I'd just as soon go get us a little trailer, a little place someplace, clear out of the state to get away from this whole place.
They've recently retained a lawyer. For Here and Now, I'm Julie Grant.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.